While the accomplishments of known white supremacists are still documented, framed, and distributed, both historical and ongoing racism in Abbotsford remains hushed. This creates tension between white and non-white people in the valley and can have dire consequences. Why is nobody talking about it? And what does this silence say about the community? This country was born out of the violent seizure of land that belonged to indigenous people across Turtle Island, and the systems that it's built upon continue to disenfranchise black people, indigenous people, and people of color every day. Abbotsford is the homeland of the Stolo, or the people of the river, now represented formally through the Sumas First Nation and the Matsqui First Nation. I'm recording this show on Coast Salish land, stolen from the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples, and I'm grateful to live and work here. I'm Ali Laube for CIVL Radio, and this is Abbotsford's Hushed History of Racism. This series was funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiative. To find the print and blog posts of this and other content from the Local Journalism Initiative, visit canada-info.ca. This content might include some explicit language. Without the labor of Asian immigrants, who ran the city's lumber mill and built railroads all over Canada, Abbotsford wouldn't be what it is today. Many of the South Asian and Japanese families in that area are second and third generation Canadians with established roots in the local community. Yet, they often aren't treated that way by their white neighbors. In a public statement released in September 2020, Heritage Abbotsford wrote that the owners of the Abbotsford Lumber Company enriched themselves while exploiting the underpaid labors of many racialized South and East Asian migrant workers in the early years of the 20th century. The construction of the CPR connected the nation, that's the Canada Pacific Railroad, but it was also built under dangerous conditions by thousands of laborers. That includes about 15,000 temporary Chinese workers. Canadian Pacific is still a successful company today, and now it has 22,500 kilometers of track across North America. Christina Reed, the executive director of Heritage Abbotsford, recalls records of children being bullied at Claiborne, that's the mill. Chinese children were having their hair pulled and rocks thrown at them, according to these files. At the time, laborers, who would likely be these children's parents, were given menial jobs that were often dangerous or severely underpaid. Reed also recalls council meetings and letters to the editor from council demanding that all laborers of color be dismissed from the workforce, quote, to the benefit of the white man.
People, I think, also had an idea that they could separate out racism from, for example, business. No, it's not racism that I'm paying these people less because their skin is brown. It's just good business practice, for example, right? They don't view that, or didn't view that as racism, right? So they were used for disposable jobs because they were disposable people. So if you're wanting to deal with something that's going to explode on you, you get a Chinese person to do it. And that's when you're coming into then the 1930s, and the Depression is starting to hit here too. It was slow getting here, but once it got here, that's the first thing that you see, right, is that there's pressure put on places like the lumber mill to dismiss the colored workers and give those jobs to white people.
Ian Roxborough Smith, a co-chair of the Race and Anti-Racism Network and professor at UFB, says the lumber mill in Abbotsford exhibited a form of what he calls racial paternalism towards racialized groups. He says there were segregated hiring practices, like only hiring Japanese and Chinese workers for wages and labor standards far lower than what was given to white people. When the Great Depression hit, these workers were the first people to get fired or have their wages cut. Anti-Asian racism and xenophobia was extremely high in North America in the 20s, and Abbotsford was no exception. Roxborough Smith sees the Heritage Society's celebration of the city's massive lumber donation to the mill, and relative silence on white supremacy, as a selective, whitewashed version of history. He wants them, as well as other residents of Abbotsford, to learn, acknowledge, and share a reality that includes people of color in a more wholesome way.
When the Depression hits, like a downturn in the economy, people of color get hit the hardest, right? That was like built into the company's policies. And so I think there's this kind of mythical narrative that has been propagated somewhat by the family even to this day, that the family and the company has, you know, like brought multiculturalism, quote unquote, to the valley, right? And I really don't think that's the truth, right? I think that they're not acknowledging, you know, the racial privileges that they had, as well as the kind of racism that they had as part of their company policy. A common narrative that you'll hear about, for example, the history of the Sikh community in the valley is that the company generously donated the lumber to Sikh lumber workers to build the first gurdwara in the city, right? And like that was built in like 1911. It's like the oldest gurdwara in Canada. It's like National Historic Site. But there's still this kind of like narrative that gets pushed at the sort of like public history local level that, oh yeah, like the lumber company generously donated this lumber. And like if you go to the Heritage Society, there's the diorama in their social hall that shows the lumber workers carrying the lumber towards the gurdwara. And it's like, well, it's none of that is acknowledging discrepancies in racial hierarchies that were imposed on that at that time, right? And and I think it's not honest history, if you ask me.
The KKK's emergence in the 1920s in Abbotsford was new to many of his colleagues, says Roxborough Smith. While he finds it surprising that it has taken until this year for these stories to be more widely told, digitizing the files has provided easier access online, making it easier for people to learn about the city's past. Charles Hill Tout established and owned the Mill Lake Sawmill, but the Trethewey brothers, that's Joe, Richard, Arthur, Sam, and Bill, bought it from him in 1903. In 1912, the brothers established the Abbotsford Timber and Trading Company. The company was a huge commercial success by the 1920s. They became one of the largest employers in the province, making their money producing boards and shingles until the Great Depression. At that point, they had nearly exhausted their local resources. Forests were sparse and business was bad, so they shut it down in 1934. The Abbotsford Lions Club bought the site and converted it to Mill Lake Park, but remnants of the lives of the Japanese immigrants who worked there remain, most obviously manifested through the lilies that float on the lake, brought to Abbotsford by homesick wives of Japanese mill workers. There's a lot to say about the Trethewey family, an economically influential group of white pioneers. Christina Reed, the executive director of the Heritage Abbotsford Society, works out of a house at Abbotsford Central Mill Lake named after them. But two of the first people in Abbotsford to join the KKK were J.O. and Samuel Trethewey. That is rarely addressed, not in the history books, not in popular discourse, and not on the walls of the house built in their name. Pictures remain on the walls of Heritage Abbotsford Society, though it acknowledged the role J.O. Trethewey's brother Samuel and his son Howard had in the foundation of the KKK in the city. This is according to a public statement that they released this September.
You know, you have to make a distinction between celebrating a person and speaking about a person, so memorializing a person, right? Because we're not celebrating Sam, for example, by having his picture up. But by having his picture up, it gives us the opportunity to have the conversation about what was said and what was done back in the day. And then you have to have a big discussion with your coworkers and the community at large as to whether you should keep that picture up there.
Both of them eventually married multiple times and had children. The brothers were active in their community, which makes Reed say it's a farce to say that nobody liked them and he's not part of the Trethewey family because he's racist. Reed says Heritage Abbotsford doesn't have all the names of the people who attended the first KKK meeting in the city. However, they do know that J.O. and his son Howard attended the Klan's meetings, and Howard is believed to be one of the men who ran a garage where the meetings were held. Reed says she still has to have a discussion with her coworkers and the community at large about whether or not they want the Trethaways up on their walls.
My Indigenous member of staff here, is she actually comfortable running a tour with Sam's picture in there, knowing that he was a member of the KKK? Because I know I'm not. But then there's arguably that thing that's part of the reason why he's up there is because that gives us the opportunity to have that discussion. We shouldn't just be discussing the sort of Pollyanna version of history, because then you're lying by omission. And we're never, ever going to get past any of these things like truth and reconciliation processes and residential schools and racism and things that are not so lovely if we don't actually talk about them.
Roxborough Smith is a voting member of the Abbotsford Historical Society, who has been loudly complaining, as he says, about the name of the Trithewey House for over a year.
As far as I'm concerned, like, they should have changed the name yesterday. Like, it's ridiculous. You know, they've obviously got a lot of money, and you can directly relate that historically to the money they made off the backs of racialized workers in the 20s, right? Like, that they were exploiting in the lumber industry, right? But I think they're concerned about the legacy of the family name and then the legacy of the company. But, you know, the other thing was, like, why not consult First Nations and think about, like, Indigenous place names for the area around the lake?
He's a historian of U.S. history, but started doing research on white supremacy in Abbotsford after joining the Heritage Society board at UFV. He describes the board as a white pioneer society sort of organization dedicated to preserving or commemorating the city's colonial settler past. He has been putting pressure on his fellow members to become more multicultural, multiracial, as a historical society. Despite yielding no significant change, he doubled his efforts when Black Lives Matter created a global movement against anti-Black racism last summer. He started learning about the emergence and role of the KKK in Abbotsford during the 1920s to shed light on the issue. When Roxborough Smith discovered the Trethewey's connection to the white supremacist group, the KKK, he immediately suggested that the name of the heritage site still standing in their name be changed. This suggestion has not been implemented. Roxborough Smith also wants Heritage Abbotsford Society to publicly document this involvement in the KKK as a means of taking accountability and educating the public on the true history of what happened in the Valley, as opposed to what he refers to as a controlled narrative. For example, the claim that J.O. Trithewey, the first signatory to the KKK in Abbotsford, was a wayward son whose views didn't represent the rest of his family, is unsubstantiated, according to Smith. Reed also wants to see the house renamed, and suggests residents who agree write to the city of Abbotsford and the PRC so that the request can go through city council. If passed, it would then go on to public consultation. And after that, whether or not the site gets renamed is up to council. Reed has already had meetings with the city about this, where she made the suggestion to change the name of the Trethewey House. She's also been talking to them online, but is waiting for a follow-up, and there is no tangible action so far.
There's an agreement between the then municipality of Matsqui that this was supposed to be Trithewey House Heritage Site when it was donated. But Trithewey House is always going to be Trithewey House. It's not about renaming Trithewey House, it's about renaming the grounds. We want there to be a physical presence, a way that we can remember the people who lived here and worked here and all of that, because you've also got nothing anywhere around Mill Lake that commemorates the workers. Those are the BIPOC workers. Well, predominantly then you got Chinese, Japanese, and South Asian workers that came here, and they were handpicked to come and work here at the mill, and they lived here in bunkhouses.
Because Trithewey House is a building, it falls under the buildings department at the city. But because it's an organization that brings in tourists, it also falls under tourism. And because it's a museum, it falls under recreation and culture. Finally, because it's technically in a park, it falls under parks, which means that making a change to the site's name needs to be approved by each department before reaching the PRC. After that, it would go to the public and council, but the whole process can take a very long time. Mark Forcier from the UFV-based club Black Connections says the city of Abbotsford's inaction on changing the name is an act of defiance and an assertion of power. He says the city needs to respond to race-related issues faster and more publicly. One example of when they could have done this was during the Tanglebank All Lives Matter comment controversy, he says. Forcier says it's time for Abbotsford to stand up, acknowledge that history more publicly, and be more responsive when issues related to race and racial tension come up in the community.
Again, going back to city, just their lack of response there. Your silence is loud. It's deafening. Do you not care? Like, it's simple. You say you care. Then we know where you stand. You have said you don't care by not saying anything. And then also supporting a husband or a counselor whose just views are just not in line with what you want your community's views to be. City, shame on you for having such a poor response. I just don't think it was necessary. Like, All that was needed to say was, this is wrong, Black Lives Matter. Or, this is wrong, this will not happen to the citizens of Abbotsford. You know, this won't happen in Abbotsford. You said it a bit late or something along the lines, but you didn't really say it. You have a diverse population of people here and it continues to grow. So don't alienate and hire some people of color.
Sikh immigrants are also an enormous but undershared part of Abbotsford's history. Boulevard Group's site says that the Abbotsford Timber and Trading Company donated building materials for Abbotsford's first Sikh temple in Canada. The lumber was carried by Sikh men by hand from the lake to the building site on South Fraser Way. Some community members feel this kind of representation of Abbotsford's history whitewashes the story and ignores systemic challenges that the Sikh community faced, both then and now. Dr. Satwinder Baines, director of South Asian Studies Institute at UFB, is dedicated to addressing that concern. Her work is based on supporting minority cultural communities founded in her experiences as an immigrant and person of color in Abbotsford. She started helping other immigrants, mostly other folks from India, retell their own local histories as a way to find empowerment, identity, and national pride years ago. That remains her passion today. South Asian migration to Abbotsford started in the early 1900s, making their ancestors fourth and fifth generation Canadians, she explains. There was another wave of migration in the 70s, when immigration and multiculturalism became more liberal in Canada, as did jobs in the booming BC agricultural and industrial sectors.
People have decided that the history of South Asian migration is not important to either record or to teach. So people in positions of privilege and power, they're the ones who have decided that. So as a result, we know that the omission is a planned omission and that we have to combat it by our own planning. So my work is informed by this idea that if we don't do this, nobody else is going to do it. It is a reaction to erasure, but it's a reaction based on a very negative erasure in the sense that while people know this history exists, they willfully omit it from the record and present a very European settler history.
Baines says that Abbotsford's history is steeped in racism. That history needs to be rewritten to include the communities that have been excluded.
From the early years when first immigrants came to Canada and they were paid less than the white person, and blatantly, not even hidden, and they were told that they did the same labor, but they were worth less. From that moment on to where laws and policies protected people from doing the right thing, so they could say, you know, I do it with immunity because I know nobody can say, touch me with a 10-foot pole. The Ku Klux Klan had a chapter in Abbotsford. There was enclaves set up in Abbotsford where people only of color lived. Housing was denied to them. Certainly upward mobility was denied to them. Right to vote was denied to them. Civic participation was denied. It's an organized, legislated racism. And so the legislation supported the white supremacy. And because of that, people got away with it. So from day one, there has been, I mean, those legislations have now been repealed, but redress in terms of people looking back and saying the injustices of the past inform our present. And if the injustices cannot be unpacked and explained, you know, people have to not apologize, but certainly have to accept and reconcile to that fact that this actually happened. You know, there's not even a recognition by people who were racist to say this happened. You know, they're silent. So silence is a problem. Society has to be held to account, and society has to say that the ills of the past have to be addressed. And one of the ways to address it is to unpack it and to bring it out and to speak about it and to put it in the history books and to make sure that people learn from it.
Racism is rampant in all areas of society, whether it's overt or covert, Baines says. As a result, there's no one way to solve the problem. Rather, it's a very complex and organized way of dealing with non-dominant forces, says Baines.
You know, we're happy to live in ghettos. There's a white ghetto in Abbotsford, there's a brown ghetto in Abbotsford, you know, but the white ghetto doesn't talk about its own ghetto. It just talks about how, you know, the browns all live on the west side of Abbotsford. It doesn't say, well, the whites live on the east side. You know, it's such easy erasure. It's such easy omission, right? Suddenly it's the brown person's burden that they all live in the west side of Abbotsford. And without explaining, why does the white live on the east side? Have you talked about that? Let's talk about both. If we're going to discuss people's living habits or desires to live each other in enclaves, then let's talk about everything. But for millennia, people have only talked about social change as being the responsibility of the minority. You know, they need to change. They come to Canada. They should change. There isn't a lot of, give and take from both sides.
She too points to the segregation between white and brown people in the city as an example of how white supremacy manifests there today.
The government is still held to account by very influential, very, very government-supported church institutions. I don't think it's as separated as we'd like it to be. So as a result, politicians have to cater to church groups, to church individuals. There is still lobbying and power by the church, and the church still influences government policy. We're not that naive not to know that. So as a result, I don't think that we can say that our society is immune to the influences of the church. I think it is very much influenced. The divide can only go away if we get fully integrated in society, and I think there's still pockets of resistance towards segregation.
That process might take generations, says Baines. She's dedicated to retelling history by and for the people of color in her area to give them control over their own narratives, recording everything from small community histories and family histories to larger moments of historical significance.
The regret that our history was not told, that it wasn't recorded, now we can say, okay, we don't need to live in that regret. We can say very proudly that our history matters. And when people see their own names and their own stories reflected, they will believe in this nation more. It finally puts you in a position to say, Canada is also us. Let's not just keep studying white history. You've studied it. It's been 200 years you've been studying it. Mm-hmm. Let's give some time and energy and look at our mandates and say, okay, we also need to study other communities. Why is that not happening? We're not holding our public institutions to account to say, enough, fill the gaps. And then you have to go to them and they say, oh, I'm so glad you came to tell us to fill the gaps. So where were you? Why aren't you thinking like that? The intelligent human beings, you've been given the responsibility through taxpayers' money to do this work, but you are not thinking that this needs to be done. We have to come and remind you, or tell you, or guide you. Or they use this as tokens to say, okay, we've done it. We did some South Asian history 20 years ago, and that was done 20 years ago. We've not done anything since. But let's keep talking about that.
It takes between a year and a half to 3 years to properly mount an exhibit, but Heritage Abbotsford has already begun work on the next one, which will be about Indigenous heritage in Abbotsford. It was developed in partnership with the Stolo Research and Resource Management Center, Matski Nation, and the Fraser Basin Council.
I'm sure that racism will be part of what is up there, because you can't really start talking about Indigenous heritage anywhere in this province without having to discuss things like the Indian Act and how that impacts history and things like, why did we not have any Indigenous workers? Like, were they so racist that they wouldn't hire Indigenous workers? Well, no, but the Indigenous population in Abbotsford were stuck on the rest, so they wouldn't have been able to come to work every day. They didn't work at the mill. Well, the reason why they didn't work at the mill is because of the Indian Act, and the Indian Act is based on colonialism and racism.
That needs to be acknowledged before any progress can be made. That hasn't happened, though, in Abbotsford. People are starting to have the conversation, and researchers like Olivia Daniels at U of V have looked into it, which we'll be talking about more on the next episode. I'm Allie Laube for Civil Radio. Thanks for listening.